Side 3, Time's Eye, by Arthur C. Clarke and Stephen Baxter. Continuing on page 90. This talk made him realize how remote in time her age was, and how little he could understand of it. He said cautiously, "And has God been banished in your day, as some thinkers would predict?" She hesitated. "Not banished, Josh. But we understand ourselves better than we used to. We understand why we need gods. There are some in my time who see all religion as a psychopathology. They point to those who are prepared to torture and kill their co-religionists for the sake of a few percent difference in obscure ideology. But there are others who say that for all their flaws, the religions are attempts to address the most basic questions about existence. Even if they tell us nothing about God, they're surely telling us a great deal about what it means to be human. The Oikumens hope that by unifying religions, the result won't be a dilution but an enrichment, like the ability to study a precious gem from many angles. And maybe these tentative steps are our best hope of a true enlightenment in the future." "It sounds utopian. And is it working?" "Slowly, like the peacekeeping. If we're building a utopia, we're doing it in the dark. But we're trying, I guess." "It's a beautiful vision," he breathed. "The future must be a marvelous place." He turned to her. "How strange all this is. How exhilarating to be here with you. To be castaways in time. Together." She reached out and touched his lips with one fingertip. "Good night, Josh." She rolled away, pulled her poncho over her body, and curled up. He lay down, his pulse thumping. The next day, the ground rose steadily, becoming broken and lifeless. The clear air thinned and grew colder, bitterly cold, when the wind from the north blew, despite the brightness of the sun. By now, it was obvious there was no threat from Pashtuns or anybody else, and Batson allowed the troops to abandon the slow routine of picketing and march more briskly. Though Bassett's all-weather flight suit kept her reasonably protected, the others suffered. As they struggled into the wind, the soldiers wrapped themselves up in their blankets and groused about how they should have brought their winter greatcoats. Both Ruddy and Josh became subdued, locked in themselves, as if the wind was leeching the energy out of them. But nobody had expected these conditions. Even old frontier hands said they had never known such a chill in March. Still, they marched doggedly along. Most of the time, even Kipling didn't complain. He was too cold to bother, he said. 14 of the 20 troopers were Indian. It seemed to Possessor that the Europeans kept away from the sepoys and that the Indians had poorer equipment and weapons. Ruddy said, "Once the proportion of British troops to Indian was about 1 in 10, but the mutiny shattered all that. Now there's one European for every 3 Indians. The best weaponry and all the artillery pieces are in the hands of British troops. Now, the Indians may be used as muleteers. You don't want to train up and arm potential insurgents. Common sense, that. Remember that the Indian civil service employs only about 1,000 people. Brave men of the plains all, to administer a country of 400 million. It is only the backing of force that enables such a bluff to be played effectively." "But that's why," she said gently, "you have to train up an Indian elite. This isn't America or Australia. There's no way British colonists or their descendants will ever outnumber the Indians." Ruddy shook his head. "You're talking about a growing crowd of babus, with all respect to yourself. That notion might wash in London, but not here. You must know of Lucknow, where the whites were summarily slaughtered. That's the tinderbox we're sitting on. We may be withholding the best guns, but by filling a babu's head with visions of liberty and self-determination, you are handing him the most potent weapon of all. Weapons he isn't yet mature enough to use." Such casual patronizing set Bessessa's teeth on edge. But she knew that Ruddy was actually representative of his class, if more articulate than most. It was some consolation to her to know that Ruddy was quite wrong about the future, even what would unravel in his own lifetime. The confrontation between Cossacks and Sowars in Central Asia, so long feared in London, would never come to pass. In fact, Russia and Britain came to be allies in the face of a new enemy common to both, in the person of the Kaiser. The empire had always been about acquisition and profit, but Britain's legacy in this region wasn't all bad. It did leave India with a functioning civil service. And right up to Bessesa's time, India remained the second largest democracy in the world, second only to Europe. But the well-intended partition imposed when the Raj withdrew caused tensions from the beginning, tensions that resulted in the terrible destruction of Lahore. That was the old history, though, she reminded herself. Just in the few days they had been here, she thought she detected a change in the sepoys' attitude. They were not quite so respectful to the whites, as if they now knew something of the future, that Babus like Gandhi and Bessesa herself would eventually win. Even if time somehow stitched itself back together again, she couldn't believe that this bit of history, polluted by her own present, could ever be quite the way it had been before. Soon they found themselves clambering through high-shouldered hills, and as the northern wind was funneled into steep-walled valleys and gorges, the going got tougher still, but these were just foothills. At last they broke through a final cluttered valley and emerged to face a view of the mountains themselves. The peaks were clad in bright gray-white glaciers that descended from their summits and tumbled down their flanks. Even from here, still kilometers away, Bessesa could hear the groan and crack of the ice rivers as they forced their way down the gouged flanks of the mountains. They all stopped in their tracks, quite stunned. "Good God," said Ruddy. "The sepoys are saying it wasn't like this before." Bessesa dug out her night vision goggles and set them to a binocular setting. She scanned the base of the mountains. Beyond the peaks, the ice stretched away, she saw. This was the edge of an ice cap. "I think this is a piece of the Ice Age." Ruddy's shivering had wrapped his arms around his bulk. "Ice Age? Yes. I have heard of the phrase. A Professor Agassiz, I think. Controversial idea." "Controversial no more, then." "Another time slip?" Josh asked. "Look." Bessesa pointed at the base of the mountains. The glaciers there came to an abrupt halt, making a cliff. But the glaciers continued to pour off the mountains in their slow, inexorable way, and Bessesa could see how the cliff was splintering, carving off chunks like great landlocked icebergs, revealing clefts of a piercing blue. At the base of the cliff, the ice was already melting, and slow floods were seeping out toward the lower ground. "I think that's another interface. Like the step on the plain. There'll be a jump anything from 10,000 years to 2 million years deep." "Yes," said Josh, his breath steaming. "I see it. Another boundary between worlds. Eh, Ruddy?" But poor near-sighted Kipling could see little through his frosted spectacles. "We should head back," Batson said, his teeth chattering. "We've seen what we came to see and can go no further." The men concurred. Bessesa's radio bleeped. She pulled her headset out of her pocket and wrapped it around her head. It was a short-wave message from Casey. One of Grove's scouting expeditions had spotted what appeared to be an army, a massive one, in the Valley of the Indus. And Casey had received a signal on his lashed-up receiving station, he said. A signal from space. Her heart beat faster. Time to go, then. Before she turned away, Bessesa ran her field of view along that crumbling base of ice one last time. No wonder the weather was screwed up, she thought. This big chunk of ice wasn't meant to be here. The cold winds pouring off it would mess up the climate for kilometers around, and when it melted, there would be swollen rivers, floods. That was, of course, if things remained stable, and there wasn't more unraveling of time to come. She glimpsed movement. She scanned back, upping the magnification. 2, 3, 4 figures walked through the chill blue shadow of the glaciers. They were upright and wore something dark and heavy, skins, perhaps. They carried sticks or spears. But they were squat, broad, their shoulders massive and rounded, their muscles immense. They were like pumped-up American footballers, she thought. Casey, eat your heart out. Tiny sparks of light, well-spaced, hovered over them, a string of eyes. One of the figures stopped and turned in her direction. Had he glimpsed the reflection of her goggles? She tapped the controls and the magnification zoomed to its limit. The image grew blurred and shaky, but she could make out a face. It was broad, almost chinless, with powerful cheekbones, a forehead that sloped back from a thick brow into a mass of black hair, and a great protruding nose from which steam snorted, white and regular, as if from some hidden engine. Not human, not quite. But still, something atavistic in her felt a shock of recognition. Then the image broke down into a blur of color, white and blue. 13. Lights in the Sky. Things didn't get any easier. It was a rare day now when the sky didn't bubble with cloud. Jamrud began to be plagued by rainstorms and sometimes hail that would boil up out of nowhere. The sepoys said they had never known such weather. The British officers, though, had more on their minds than the weather. They were increasingly distracted by the sketchy reports their scouts brought back of an army of some kind to the southwest, and they were scrambling for ways to bring back more complete information. But for all their difficulties, the castaways of Jamrud were learning a great deal more about their new world, for as the crew of the Soyuz followed their lonely cycles around the planet, they downloaded images and other data to Casey's improvised receiving station. Casey used what was left of the little bird's avionics to store, process, and display the data. The Soyuz's storm-streaked images of a transformed world were bewildering, but they captivated all who studied them in different ways. Nicessa thought that for Casey and Abdikadir, even though the images in themselves were disturbing, they were a reassuring reminder of home, where they had been used to having the ability to call up images like this whenever they chose. But soon the Soyuz must fall to Earth, and their sole eye in the sky would close. As for the men of 1885, Ruddy, Josh, Captain Grove, and the rest were at first simply gosh-wowed by the display, soft screens, and other gadgets. While Casey and Abdi were comforted by familiarity, Ruddy and the others were distracted by novelty. Then, once they got used to the technology, the British were struck by the marvel of looking at images of a world from space. Even though the Soyuz was only a few hundred kilometers up, a glimpse of a curved horizon, of cloud banks sailing on layers of air, or of familiar, recognizable features like India's teardrop shape or Britain's fractal coastlines would send them into paroxysms of wonder. "I had never imagined such a godlike perspective was possible," Ruddy said. "Oh, you know how big the world is in round, fat numbers," he thumped his belly. "But I had never felt it, not in here. How small and scattered are the works of man. How petty his pretensions and passions. How like ants we are." But the 19th century crowd soon got past that and learned to interpret what they were seeing. Even the stiffer military types like Grove surprised Bisessa with their flexibility. It took only a couple of days after the first download before the chattering, awestruck crowds around Casey's soft screen began to grow more somber. For no matter how marvelous the images and the technology that had produced them, the world they revealed was sobering indeed. Bisessa took copies of all this to store in their only significant portable electronic device, her phone. The data was precious, she saw. For a long time, these images would be all they would have to tell them what was on the other side of the horizon. And besides, she agreed with cosmonaut Kolya that there should be a record of where they had come from. Otherwise, people would eventually forget and believe that this was all there ever had been. But the phone had its own agenda. "Show me the stars," it said in its small whisper. So each evening she would set it up on a convenient rock, where it sat like a patient metallic insect, its small camera peering into the sky. Bisessa put up little screens of waterproofed canvas to protect it. These observation sessions could last hours as the phone waited for a glimpse of some key part of the sky through the scudding clouds. One evening, as Bisessa sat with her phone, Abdikadir, Josh, and Ruddy walked out of the fort to join her. Abdikadir brought a tray of drinks, fresh lemonade, and sugar water. Ruddy grasped the nature of the phone's project readily enough. By mapping the sky and comparing the stars' positions to the astronomical maps stored in its database, the phone could determine the date. "Just like astronomers at the Babylonian court," he said. Josh sat close to Bisessa, and his eyes were huge in the gathering dark of the evening. He could not be called handsome. He had a small face with protruding ears and cheeks pushed up by smiling. His chin was weak, but his lips were full and oddly sensual. He was an endearing package, she admitted to herself. And though she felt obscurely guilty about it, as if she was somehow betraying Myra, his obvious affection for her was coming to matter to her. He said, "Do you think that even the stars have been washed around the sky?" "I don't know, Josh," she said. "Perhaps that's my sky up there. Perhaps it's yours. Perhaps it's nobody's. I want to find out." Ruddy said, "Surely by the 21st century you have a much deeper understanding of the nature of the cosmos, even of time and space themselves, than we poor souls." "Yes," said Josh eagerly. "You may not know why all this has happened to us, but surely, Bisessa, armed with your advanced science, you can speculate on how the world has been turned upside down. Abdelkader put in, maybe, but it's going to be a little difficult to talk about space-time, as you wouldn't have even heard of special relativity for another couple of decades. Ruddy looked blank. Of special what? The phone whispered dryly, start with chasing a light beam. If it was good enough for Einstein... All right, the assessor said. Josh, think about this. When I look at you, I don't see you as you are now. I see you as you were a little way in the past, a few fractions of a second ago, the time it took starlight reflecting from your face to reach my eye. Josh nodded. So far, so clear. The assessor said, suppose I chased the light from your face, going faster and faster. What would I see? Josh frowned. It would be like two fast trains, one overtaking the other. Both fast, but from the point of view of the one, the other seems to move slowly. He smiled. You would see my cheeks and mouth moving like a glacier when I smiled to greet you. Yes, she said. Good, you've got the idea. Now, Einstein, he was a physicist of the early 20th century, an important one. Einstein taught us this isn't just an optical effect. It's not just that I see your face move more slowly, Josh. Light is the most fundamental way we have of measuring time. And so the faster I travel, the slower I see time pass for you. Ruddy pulled at his mustache. Why? Abdelkader laughed. 5 generations of schoolteachers since Einstein have failed to come up with a good answer to that, Ruddy. It's just the way the universe is built. Josh grinned. How wonderful. That light should be forever young, forever ageless. Perhaps it's true that God's angels are creatures of light itself. Ruddy shook his head. Angels or no angels, this is damned fishy. And what does it have to do with our present situation? Because, the assessor said, in a universe where time itself adjusts around you depending on how fast you travel, the concept of simultaneity is a little tricky. What is simultaneous for Josh and Ruddy, say, may not be simultaneous for me. It depends on how we move, how the light passes between us. Josh nodded, but he was evidently uncertain. And this isn't simply an effect of timing. Not timing, but physics, the assessor said. I think I see, Josh said. And if that can happen, it may be possible to take 2 events that were not simultaneous. Let's say a moment in my life in 1885 and a moment in Bessessa's in 2037. And bring them together so that they touch so closely we can even... Kiss, said Ruddy mock solemnly. Poor Josh actually blushed. Ruddy said, but all this is described from the point of view of one person or another. From what mighty point of view, then, is our new world to be seen? That of God, or of the eye of time itself? I don't know, the assessor said. We need to learn more, Josh said decisively, if we're ever to have a chance of fixing things. Oh, yes, Ruddy laughed hollowly. There is that, fixing things. Abdelkader said, in our age, we've grown used to our seas and rivers and air being fouled. Now time is no longer a steady, remorseless stream, but churned up, full of turbulence and eddies. He shrugged. Perhaps it's just something we will have to get used to. Perhaps the truth is simpler, Ruddy said brutally. Perhaps your noisy, flapping machines have shattered the cathedral calm of eternity. The whizzes and bangs of the terrible wars of your age have shocked the walls of that cathedral beyond their capacity to heal. Josh looked from one to the other. You're saying all this might not be natural. It might not even be the actions of some superior beings. It might be our fault. Maybe, said Bessessa, but maybe not. We only know a little more science than you, Josh. We really don't know. Ruddy was still brooding on relativity. Who was this fellow? Did you say Einstein? Sounds German to me. Abdelkader said, he was a German Jew. In your time he was, a 6-year-old schoolboy in Munich. Ruddy was muttering, space and time themselves can be warped. There is no certainty, even in physics. How Einstein's opinions must have helped the world toward flux and disintegration. And now you say he was Hebrew and a German. It's so inevitable it makes one laugh. The phone said quietly,
"Miss Sessa, there's one more thing."
"What?"
"Tau Ceti,"
Joss said. "What is that?" "Oh, a star."
"A star like the sun, about 12 light years away. I saw it, Nova. It was faint, and by the time I noticed it, the light was already fading, already past its peak. It lasted only a few nights, but..."
Abdelkader pulled his beard. "What's so remarkable about that?"
"Just that it's impossible," said the phone.
"How so?"
"Only binary systems, Nova. A companion has to add inert material to the star, which is eventually blown off in an explosion."
"And Tau Ceti is solitary," Bessessa said. "So how can it have gone Nova?"
"You can check my records," the phone said tetrally.
Bessessa looked at the sky uncertainly. Ruddy grumbled, "In the circumstances, that seems a rather remote and abstract puzzle to me. Perhaps we should concern ourselves with more immediate matters. Yon phone has been working on its Babylonian date calculating for days already. How long will it take to deliver its marvelous news?" "That's up to the phone. It's always had a mind of its own." He laughed. "Sir Gadget, tell me what you have surmised, as best you can, incomplete as it may be. I order it." The phone said,
"Miss Sessa."
She had set up nanny safeguards to ensure the phone didn't say too much to the British. But now she shrugged. "It's okay, phone."
"The 13th century,"
the phone whispered. Ruddy leaned closer. "When?"
"It's hard to be more exact. The changes in the star's positions are slight. My cameras are designed for daylight, and I have to take long exposure images. The clouds are a pain in the ass. There are a number of lunar eclipses in the period. If I observe one of those, I may be able to pin it down to the exact day."
"The 13th century, though," Ruddy breathed, and he peered up at a cloud-littered sky. "Six centuries from home." "For us, eight," Bessessa said grimly. "But what does that mean? It might be a 13th century sky, but for sure the world we are standing on isn't 13th century Earth. Jamrud doesn't belong there, for instance." Josh said, "Perhaps the 13th century is a foundation, like the underlying fabric onto which the other fragments of time, making up this great chronological counterpane of a world, have been stitched."
"Sorry to be the bearer of bad news," the phone said.
Bessessa shrugged. "I think it's more complex than bad." Ruddy lay back against the rock, hands clasped behind his broad head, the clouds reflected in his thick glasses.
"The 13th century," he said wistfully. "What a marvelous journey this is turning out to be. I thought I was coming to the northwest frontier, and that was adventure enough, but to be whisked to the Middle Ages. But I admit it isn't wonder I feel at the moment, nor even fear over the fact that we are lost."
Josh sipped his lemonade. "What then?" Ruddy said, "When I was 5 years old, I was sent to stay with foster parents in Southsea. It's a common practice, of course, for if you're an emigre parent, you want your children to be grounded in Blighty. But at five, I knew nothing of that. I hated that place as soon as I set foot in it. Lorne Lodge, the house of desolation. I was punished regularly, in truth, for the dreadful crime simply of being me. My sister and I would comfort ourselves by playing at Robinson Crusoe, never dreaming I would one day become a Robinson Crusoe in time. I wonder where poor Trix is now. But what hurt most about my situation I see now was that I had been abandoned, as I saw it then, betrayed by my parents, and left in that desolate place of misery and pain." "And so it is here," Josh mused. "Once I was abandoned by my parents," Ruddy said bitterly. "Now we are abandoned by God himself." That silenced them for a while. The night seemed huge under a sky populated even by alien stars. Bessessa hadn't felt quite so stranded since the moment of the discontinuity, and she ached for Myra. Abdelkader said gently, "Ruddy, your parents meant the best, didn't they? It's just that you didn't understand how you felt." Josh said, "Are you suggesting that whoever is responsible for what has happened to the world, God or not, actually means well?" Abdelkader shrugged. "We are human, and the world has been transformed by forces that are clearly superhuman. Why should we expect to understand the motives behind such forces?" Ruddy said, All right. But do any of us actually believe there can be benevolence behind this meddling? Nobody replied. 14. Last orbit. Suddenly it was their last orbit. Perhaps the last orbit of Earth ever to be traveled by humans, Collier thought wistfully. But the necessary preparation was unchanged, and once their training kicked in, the three of them began to work together as effectively as they had since the start of this strange adventure. In fact, Collier suspected they were all comforted by the familiar routine. The first task was to pack the living compartment with their garbage, including most of the contents of their post-landing survival kit already consumed. Sable stowed her scavenged ham radio gear in the descent compartment, however, but it could still be useful after landing. Now it was time to suit up. They took turns in the living compartment. First, Collier pulled on his elasticized trousers, tight enough to squeeze body fluids up toward his head, which ought to help him avoid fainting after the landing. Invaluable, but grossly uncomfortable. Next, he pulled himself into the suit itself. He had to climb in legs first through a hole in the stomach area. The inner layer of a tough, rubbery material was airtight, and the outer layer of a hardy, man-made fabric was equipped with pockets, zippers, and flaps. Under gravity, this assembly would have been all but impossible to don without the support of the ground crew. But here he thrashed around until he got his legs in place, his arms in the sleeves, the back fitting snugly. He was used to his suit. It even smelled like him, and in case of disaster, it would save his life. But after the freedom of weightlessness, he felt as if he had been locked up inside a tractor tire. Suited up, he scrambled back down into the descent compartment. The three of them strapped in. Musa had them don their helmets and gloves and ran a pressure check on the suits. For the last time, the Soyuz passed over India, and their radio footprint reached Jamrud. The little speaker Sable had rigged to her ham radio gear crackled to life.
Arthic, calling Soyuz. Come in. Soyuz, Arthic, come in.
Musa called.
Soyuz here, Casey. How is our trusty Capcom today?
The rain is pissing on me. More important, how are you?
Musa glanced at his crew.
We are strapped in, tight as three bugs in a rug. Our systems check out, despite the additional time we have spent in orbit. We are ready for the descent.
That Soyuz is a tough old bird.
That she is. I will be sorry to say goodbye to her.
Musa, you understand we have no way of tracking you. We won't know where you come down.
We know where you are, Musa said. We will find you, my friend.
God and Karl Marx willing.
Collier suddenly, urgently, didn't want this contact to be lost. They were all aware that Casey and his people were just another handful of castaways, as lost and helpless as they were. But at least Casey's was a 21st century voice reaching them from the ground. It was almost as if they had touched home again.
I must say something. Musa put his hand to his wraparound headset. Casey, Bissessa, Abdikadir, and Sable and Collier, all of you. We are far from home. We have come on a journey whose nature we can't even grasp. And I think it's clear that this new world, made of patches snipped from space and time, is not ours. It is made from pieces of Earth, but it is not Earth. So I think we should not call this new world our world. Earth. We need a new name, Casey said.
Like what?
I have thought about this, Musa said. Mir. We should call this new planet Mir.
Sable guffawed.
You want to call a planet after an antique Russian space station?
But Collier said, I understand. In our language, the word Mir can mean both world and peace.
We like the idea down here, Casey said.
Then Mir it is, said Musa.
Sable shrugged.
Whatever, she said cruelly. So you got to name a world, Musa. But what does a name matter?
Collier murmured, you know, I wonder where we would all be if we hadn't happened to be in just that bit of the sky, just at that moment.
Casey said, too much double-dome horseshit for a jock like me. I can't even keep rain out neck.
Musa glanced at Collier.
Our signal is breaking up.
Yeah, likewise. Losing you.
Yes, goodbye for now, Casey.
Won't be a welcome back. Welcome to your new home. Welcome to Mir.
The signal faded out. 15. New World. Not long after dawn, Bessessa and Abdelkadir made for the wreck of the chopper. The overnight rain continued unrelenting, stippling the muddy parade ground with tiny craters. Abdelkadir briefly pulled back the hood of his poncho and lifted up his face to the rain, tasting it.
Salty, he said. Big storms out there.
A lean-to had been set up against the side of the downed chopper. Huddled under the canvas, Casey and the British were all so splashed with mud they looked as if they had been molded out of the earth themselves. But Cecil de Morgan wore his customary suit and was almost dapper despite a few splashes. Bessessa would never like the man, but she admired his defiance of nature. Captain Grove had requested a briefing from Casey on what had been discovered so far. So Casey, propping himself up on a crutch, had used a bit of chalk to sketch an outline Mercator projection world map onto the chopper's hull. And he had set up a soft screen on a trestle chair before it.
Okay, Casey said briskly. First, the big picture.
The dozen officers and civilians standing in the uncertain shelter of the lean-to clustered to see as images of a changed world flickered by. The shapes of the continents were familiar enough, but within their coastlines, the land was a jigsaw of irregular slices, of browning green or melting white, showing how the peculiar fragmentation of time had occurred all across the planet. Few people seemed to have made it through the discontinuity. The night side of the world was almost complete darkness, broken only by a scattered handful of brave, defiant, man-made lights. And then there was the weather. Great storm systems boiled out of the oceans, or the poles, or the hearts of the continents, and thunderstorms spanned continents with branching purple-gray pyrotechnics. Casey tapped the world map.
We think we're looking at land masses that have been replaced in patches by bits of themselves from earlier eras. But so far as we can tell, given the Soyuz wasn't properly equipped and all, there's only a slight shift in the overall position of the land masses. That limits us in time, even though we think the small shifts that do exist might be enough to trigger volcanism later on.
Already Ruddy had his hand up.
Of course the land masses haven't shifted, as you put it. Why should they?
Casey growled.
For you, Alfred Wegener, as a 5-year-old boy. Tectonic plates, drifting continents. Long story, take my word.
Bessessa asked, how deep in time, Casey?
We don't think there can be any scrap that's more than 2 million years old.
Ruddy laughed a little wildly.
Only 2 million years. That's a comfort, is it?
Casey said, the time slices presumably extend up from the surface of the Earth and down at least some distance to its center, maybe all the way. Maybe each slice is a great spiky wedge of core, mantle, crust, and sky.
Grove said, and each patch brought in its own vegetation, inhabitants, a column of air above it. Looks like it. It's the mixing of the patches that we think is stirring up the weather.
He tapped the soft screen. It displayed images of massive tropical storms, creamy white swirls pouring up from the southern Atlantic to batter the eastern American seaboard, and fronts of bubbling black cloud laced across Asia.
Casey said, some of the slices must be from summer, some from winter. And the Earth's climate fluctuates on longer cycles. Ice ages come and go. And that's all mixed in, too.
He showed images of a slab of ice-bound land, a neat, near rectangle set square over the site of Paris in France.
Hot air rises above cold, and that causes the winds. Hot air holds more water vapor than cold air, and over cool land it dumps it out. And that's your rain, and so on. As all that works itself out, we get this screwed-up weather.
Abdelkadir said, how far do these slices extend upward?
We don't know, Casey said.
Not as far as the moon, surely, piped up Corporal Batson. Or that body would have vanished, or be scattered about its orbit.
Casey raised his eyebrows.
Good point. Hadn't thought of that. But we do know it reaches out at least as far as low Earth orbit.
The Soyuz, Bessessa said.
Yeah. This their clocks agree with ours to the second. They must have been flying overhead. Pure chance. When the discontinuity hit, and they were brought along with us.
He rubbed his fleshy nose.
We've tried to map the time slices, and in some places we can. Here's the Sahara.
He showed patches of greenery in the desert, mostly irregularly shaped, but some were bounded by geometrically pure arcs and straight lines.
One patch of desert looks much the same as another, even if they're 500,000 years apart in time. Still, it's possible to date some of the patches, roughly, from geological changes.
He turned and drew a big chalk asterisk on Central Africa.
This seems to be the oldest area of all. You can tell by the width of the Rift Valley. And look, the Sahara doesn't extend nearly so far south, and there are lakes, patches of green. That's just an average, though. On the ground, it's all mixed up.
More images blurred by.
We think much of Asia is from the last couple of thousand years or so. You see scattered human habitations out on those steppes, but nothing advanced. Streaks of smoke from campfires, no electric lights. The biggest concentration of people looks to be here.
He tapped an area north of China in eastern Asia.
We don't know who they are.
He continued his show and tell, guiding his reluctant audience around a transformed world. Australia looked exotic. Though much of its center was burned red raw, just as in Bessesse's time, around the coasts and in the river valleys, the greenery was thick and luxurious. A few high magnification shots were detailed enough to show animals. Bessesse made out a thing like a hippo browsing at greenery at the edge of a forest scrap. And in a short animated sequence, a herd of some huge upright creature came leaping out of cover, perhaps fleeing some predator. They were giant kangaroos, Bessesse thought. Australia seemed to have reverted to its virgin state before the arrival of humans. South America, meanwhile, was a bank of solid green. The rainforest, decimated and dying in Bessesse's time, restored to its antique glory here. In North America, a great slab of ice lay sprawled across the north and east, extending up to the pole and down to the latitude of the Great Lakes. Casey said, "The ice in this area comes from different ages. You can see that by the gaps and the ragged edges." He showed close-ups of the southern edge of the cap, which looked like a piece of paper ripped across roughly. Bessesse could see glaciers pouring off that ragged edge, great ice-dammed lakes of floodwater building up, and ferocious storm systems pooling, presumably where cold ice age air spilled off the cap and ran over warmer land. To the south of the ice, the land was a bare green-brown. Tundra, locked in by permafrost, scoured by the winds off the ice cap. At first glance, she could see no sign of people. But then she recalled people were a recent addition to America's fauna. Abdikadir said, "What about Alaska? The shape looks odd to me."
Casey said, "It's extending toward Beringia. You know, the land bridge that once stretched from Asia to America across the Bering Straits? The way the first humans walked into North America. But it's been cut off. The sea is broken through."
The tour continued relentlessly. They watched the flickering images uneasily. "And Europe?" Buddy asked, his voice tight. "England?" Casey showed them Europe. Much of the continent was covered by dense green forest. On the more open southern regions in France, Spain, Italy, there were settlements, but they were just scattered villages, perhaps not even constructed by humans, Bessesse mused, recalling that southern Europe had been in the range of the Neanderthals. There was certainly nothing human to be seen in England, which, south of the line of what would have been Hadrian's Wall, was a slab of dense, unbroken forest. Further north, the pine forest was marred by a great white scar that straddled the Scottish Highlands, a rogue section of an ice cap escaped from a glaciation age.
"It is gone," said Ruddy.
Bessesse was surprised to see his eyes behind his thick spectacles were misting.
"Perhaps it is because I was born abroad that this affects me so. But home is gone, all of it. All that history down to the Romans and even deeper. Vanished like dew."
Captain Grove put a scarred hand on his shoulder.
"Cheer up, man. We'll clear that bloody forest and build our own history if we have to, you'll see."
Ruddy nodded, seeming unable to speak. Casey watched this little melodrama, wide-eyed, his gum-chewing briefly suspended. Then he said,
"I'll cut to the chase. The Soyuz found only 3 sites on the whole damn planet where there's signs of any advanced technical culture. And one of them is right here. The second..."
He tapped his graffiti map at the southern tip of the unmistakable shape of Lake Michigan.
"Chicago,"
Josh breathed.
"Yeah," Casey said, "but don't get your hopes up. We can see dense urban settlement, a lot of smoke as if from factories, even what looks like steamboats on the lake. But they didn't respond to the Soyuz's radio signals."
"They could be from any era before the development of radio," Abdelkadir said.
"Say, 1850. Even then the population was sizable."
"Yeah," Casey growled, pulling up images on his soft screen.
"But they have problems of their own right now. They are surrounded by ice.
The hinterland is gone. No farmland. And no trade, because there's nobody to trade with.
And where, Bicesa said slowly, is the third advanced site?
Casey pulled up an image of the Middle East. Here. There's a city. Small, we think ancient. Not like Chicago. But what's interesting about it is that Soyuz picked up a radio signal from there. The only one on the planet, save for ours. But it wasn't like ours. It's powerful, but regular. Just an upward chirp through the frequencies.
A beacon, perhaps, Abdelkadir said.
Maybe. It's not one of our designs.
Bicesa peered at the soft screen. The city was set in a broad expanse of green, apparently cultivated land, laced with suspiciously straight waterways, like shining threads.
I think this is Iraq.
That, said Cecil de Morgan firmly, is Babylon.
Ruddy gasped.
Babylon lives again.
And that's all, Casey said. Just us and this beacon in Babylon.
They fell silent. Babylon. The very name was exotic to Bicesa, and her head buzzed with speculation about how that strange beacon had got there. Captain Grove seized the moment. The little man stepped forward, mighty mustache bristling, and he clapped his hands briskly.
Well, thank you, Mr. Rothick. Here's the way I see it. We have to concentrate on our own position, since it's clear that nobody is about to come to our rescue, so to speak. Not only that, I think we have to find something to do, to give ourselves a goal. It's time we stop reacting to whatever the gods throw at us and start taking command.
Hear, hear, Ruddy murmured.
I'm open to suggestions.
We must go to Chicago, Josh said. With so many people, so much industry, so much potential.
They don't know we're here, Casey said bluntly. Or perhaps they saw Soyuz pass overhead, but even if they did, they won't have understood.
And we have no way to reach them, Captain Grove said. We're scarcely in a position to mount a transatlantic crossing. Perhaps in the future. But for now, we must put Chicago out of our minds.
Babylon, said Abdelkadir.
It's the obvious goal. And there's that beacon. Perhaps we will learn more of what has become of us.
Grove nodded.
Besides, I like the look of all that green. Wasn't Babylon an early center of agriculture? A fertile crescent and all that?
Perhaps we should consider a relocation up there. A march wouldn't be impossible.
Abdelkadir smiled.
You're thinking of farming, Captain?
It's hardly been my lifelong ambition, but needs must, Mr. Omar.
Bicesa pointed out,
but somebody lives there already.
Grove's face hardened.
We'll deal with that when we get there.
In that moment, Bicesa glimpsed something of the steel that had enabled these British to build an empire that spanned the planet. There was no serious alternative suggestion. Babylon, it would be. The party began to break up into smaller groups, talking, planning. Bicesa was struck by a new sense of purpose, of direction. Josh, Ruddy, and Abdelkadir walked back across the mud with Bicesa. Abdelkadir said,
Grove is a smart cookie.
What do you mean?
His eagerness to go to Babylon. It's not just so we can plow fields. There will be women there. Before his men start mutinying, you mean?
Josh grinned uneasily.
Think of it. 500 Adams and 500 Eves.
Ruddy said,
You're right that Grove is a good officer. He's very aware of the mood in the barrack rooms and the mess.
Many of the men who had happened to be at Jumru during the discontinuity were 3-year-olds, Ruddy said, short service troops.
Few of them have pipe clay in the marrow.
Pipe clay was the whitener the troops used on their belts.
They're actually keeping their spirits up remarkably well. But that mood won't last long, once they realize how little chance there is that any of us is going home any time soon.
Babylon might be just the thing.
Abdelkadir said, You know, we are fortunate in having the Soyuz and so much data, but we've lots of unanswered questions. That 2-million-year frame is interesting, for instance.
How so?
Because 2 million years is about the date of the emergence of Homo erectus, the first hominid. Some predecessor species, like the Pithecines the British captured, overlapped for a time, but
you think the time frame has something to do with us?
It may be just a coincidence,
but why not 1 million years? Why not 20 or 200 million?
And the oldest parts of this world quilt seem to be where we are oldest, and the youngest, like the Americas, where we reached last.
Perhaps this new world is somehow a representative sampling of human and hominid history.
She shuddered. But so much of the world is empty. The history of Homo sapiens is just the last chapter of the long, slow story of hominid evolution. We are mere dust floating on the surface of history, Bisessa. Perhaps that's what the state of this world shows us. It's a fair sample across time.
Josh tugged at Bisessa's sleeve. Something has occurred to me. It may not have struck you or the others, but then my perspective as a man of the 19th century is different.
Spit it out, Josh.
You look out at this new world, and you see scraps of your past. But I see a little of my future, too, and you. Why should you be the last? Why, Bisessa, is there nothing of your own future?
The thought struck her all at once, fully formed. She felt shocked it hadn't occurred to her. She had no reply.
Captain Grove, over here!
Corporal Batson on the edge of the parade ground was waving. Grove hurried over. Bisessa and the others followed. Batson was with a small group of soldiers, a British corporal and a number of sepoys who were holding two men. These strangers had their hands tied behind their back. They were shorter, stockier than the sepoys, and more muscular. They both wore knee-length smocks of faded purple, tied at the waist with bits of rope and strapped-up leather sandals. Their faces were broad and swarthy and roughly shaved, their black hair curly and cropped short. They were crusted with dried blood, and they were evidently terrified of the sepoys' guns. When a soldier playfully lifted his rifle, one of the pair cried out and tumbled to his knees. Grove stood before this pair, fists on his hips.
"Leave them alone, man, for God's sake! Can't you see they're terrified?"
The sepoy backed off sheepishly. Ruddy stared at the newcomers gleefully. Grove snapped.
"Well, Mitchell, what have you brought home? What kind of Pashtuns are these?"
"Dunno, sir," said the corporal. His accent was broad West Country English. "Not Pashtuns, I don't think. Was patrolling down southwest."
Mitchell's party had been sent by Grove to scout out the army they had spied down there. It seemed that the strangers were scouts sent the other way with the same idea in mind.
"Actually, there was three of them, on pudgy little horses like pit ponies. They had spears that they chucked, and then they came at us with knives. Three against half a dozen. We had to shoot the horses out from under them, and then one of the three dead before these two would give up. Even when their horses went down, they just rolled off and started tugging at them to get them up again, like they couldn't understand they had been shot."
Ruddy said dryly to Grove, "If you'd never seen a gun, Captain, you'd be dumbfounded if your horse just went down from under you like that."
Captain Grove said, "What's your point, sir?"
"That these men may come from a different time, a time more remote than any Pashtun." The two strangers listened to this conversation, mouths open. Then they jabbered excitedly, wide-eyed with fear, unable to drag their gaze from the sepoys' guns.
"That sounds like Greek," Ruddy muttered.
Josh said,
"Greeks? In India?"
Bisessa held her phone up to the strangers.
"Phone, can you?" "I'm smart technology, but not that smart," the phone said. "I think it's some archaic dialect."
Cecil De Morgan stepped out of the crowd, adjusting his mud-spattered morning jacket with an easy self-awareness.
"A rather fine education was once wasted on me. I still recall a little of my Euripides."
He spoke rapidly to the strangers. They jabbered back. De Morgan held his hands up, obviously telling them to slow down, and spoke again. After a minute of this, De Morgan turned to Grove.
"I think we're getting through, Captain, if imperfectly."
Grove said,
"Ask them where they're from, and when."
Ruddy said, "They wouldn't understand the question, Captain, and we probably wouldn't understand the answer."
Grove nodded.
Bisessa admired his imperturbability.
"Then ask them who commands them."
It took De Morgan a couple of tries to get that across, but Bisessa could understand the answer without interpretation.
"Alejandre! Alejandre!"
Abdikadir stepped forward, his eyes alive with a wild surmise.
"He did come this way. Is it possible?
Is it possible?"
16. Re-entry. The retro rocket burn was brief, a push in the back, but it was enough to knock them out of orbit. So it was done, the decision made, and whatever remained of Collier's life, minutes or years, was irrevocably shaped as a consequence. After launch, re-entry was the most dangerous part of a space mission.
But the great energies expended to inject them into orbit now had to be dissipated in friction against the air. The only in-flight casualties of Kolya's country's space program had occurred at re-entry, and he remembered those poor cosmonauts in his heart now, as he remembered the crew of the lost space shuttle Columbia. But there was nothing to do but wait. The Soyuz was designed to bring itself home without support from the ground or instructions from its crew. Kolya, who had been trained as a pilot, longed to be less a passenger, to be more in control of events, to have a joystick in front of him, to do something to bring the ship home. He glanced out of his window. The tangled jungles of South America, laced by cloud, passed for the last time beneath the prow of the spaceship. He wondered if anybody would ever see such a sight again, and how soon it would be before even the existence of such a place as this remote continent was forgotten. But as the Soyuz passed over the Americas toward the Atlantic, he saw a storm, a creamy white spiral, that sat like an immense spider across the Gulf of Mexico. Minor storms spun off across the Caribbean islands, Florida, Texas, and Mexico. These children of the monster in the Gulf were themselves devastatingly powerful, and it scratched deep gouges into the forest that covered Central America. Worse, the Central Mother storm system was itself edging north, and surely little would be spared from Houston to New Orleans. This was the second superstorm system they had seen in the last few days. The remnants of the first were still coursing across the eastern United States and the western Atlantic. But there was nothing the cosmonauts could do for anybody on the ground, not even warn them. Right on time, there was a series of bangs from above and below. The craft shuddered, feeling subtly lighter. Explosive bolts had detonated, jettisoning the descent compartment from the other two sections of the Soyuz. The rocket engines and their garbage would now burn up like meteors to baffle whoever was down there on the ground. They endured the next few minutes in a silence broken only by the ticking of their instruments, the humming of the air supply. But the small noises of the various gadgets were almost cozy, like being in a home workshop, Kolya thought. He knew he was going to miss this environment. As they fell across the sky, the resistance of the thickening air began to bite. Kolya watched the deceleration build up on the meter before him. 0.1G, 0.2G. Soon he began to feel it. Pushed back into his couch, his straps felt loose, and he tightened them. But the rise in pressure wasn't steady. The upper atmosphere was lumpy, and the compartment shuddered as it fell, like an airliner passing through turbulence. Kolya was aware, as he had been during no previous descent, of the smallness and fragility of the capsule within which he was falling to the ground. Through his window now he could see only the blackness of space. But a deep color seeped into that blackness, first brown, like old dried blood, but quickly lighter, climbing the spectrum through red, orange, yellow. As the air thickened, the deceleration became savage, rising rapidly through a single gravity and climbing to 2, 3, 4 G's. The light outside of atoms of air smashed to bits by their passage, climbed to white now, and a pearly glow shone through the windows, casting a pale, beautiful illumination over their suited laps. It was like being inside a fluorescent light bulb, he thought. But the windows blackened as the outside of the capsule was scorched by the ionized air, and the angelic light was obscured. And still the buffeting continued. The capsule shuddered, throwing them from side to side and against each other, despite the straps. It was a much more severe ride even than the launch had been. And after 3 months in space, Kolya wasn't well equipped to cope with it. He found it hard even to breathe, and he knew that he could not have lifted a finger, no matter how urgent the task. At last the ride smoothed out. There was another sharp bang from outside the wall, startling him. A window shield had blown off, taking the soot with it, to reveal a slab of startlingly clear blue sky. Not the sky of Earth, the sky of a new world, the sky of Mir. The first parachute deployed, a drogue that snatched at the air. The descent compartment swung violently through 2, 3, 4 swings, and then the main chute yanked at the capsule, making it rock again. Kolya could just make out the wide orange canopy of the main chute above him. It was hard to believe it was only 10 minutes or so since they had jettisoned the other parts of the Soyuz, perhaps 5 since first entering the atmosphere. He could feel gravity's invisible fingers pulling at his internal organs. Even his head was heavy, as if made of concrete, too heavy for his neck. But he felt only a huge relief. The most dangerous part of the descent was already over. As touchdown approached, compressed gas hissed. Kolya found his seat rising up as its base was pressurized to serve as a shock absorber.
pushing him up against the instrument console and increasing his discomfort further.
Christ, Sable growled, similarly squashed up. I will be so damn glad to get out of this tractor cabin.
It has served you well, was Musa's level reply. Only a few minutes more.
But Kolya relished those minutes, uncomfortable as he was. The last minutes in which the ship's automated systems cushioned him, perhaps the last minutes of his old life.
Proximity light, called Musa.
Kolya braced. There was a brief roar as rockets fired just a couple of meters from the ground. And then there was a slam as they hit the ground and bounced up again. After a breathless second, the cabin came down again, scraped loudly, and leapt into the air once more with a shudder. Kolya knew what that meant. The Soyuz was being dragged over the ground by its parachute.
Shit! Sable shouted. There must be a wind.
If we tip over, Musa said, his voice made uneven by the jarring, we could have trouble extricating ourselves.
Maybe you should have thought of that before, Sable yelled.
Another slam, a scraping ride, a bounce. Though the padding of his suit protected his body, Kolya found his head rattling inside his helmet, his forehead slamming against the faceplate. There was nothing they could do but endure the ride and pray that the capsule didn't tip. But then, with a final bounce and scrape, the capsule was still, and it was upright. They sat there, scarcely breathing. Musa quickly punched a button to release the parachute. Kolya was unbearably hot. He could feel sweat puddled under his back inside the suit. He reached out, his arm felt enormously heavy, and searched for Musa's gloved hand. For a moment, they held each other, reassuring themselves of their continued existence.
We are all right, panted Musa. We are down.
Yes, said Sable, her voice a gasp.
But down where?
Even now there was some routine, as they worked to close down the spacecraft's remaining systems. Kolya turned off the ventilator and took off his helmet and gloves. A valve to allow in air from outside had opened some minutes before the landing, and Kolya tasted air that was noticeably free of the dust that had plagued the Soyuz. Musa grinned at him.
I can smell pollen.
Yes.
It was a sweet, smoky aroma. Pollen, a kind of wormwood, grew all over the steppe. The familiar scent seemed to invigorate Kolya.
Perhaps this mirror of yours won't be so strange after all.
Musa grunted. There's only one way to find out.
He punched another button. Latches clicked. The hatch above their heads sprung open, and Kolya saw a circle of cloud-choked gray sky. More fresh air pushed into the cabin. Musa released his straps and pushed at his couch.
This is the part I have been dreading.
He had to be the first to move because of his central position. Slowly moving like a very old man, he struggled to his feet. Normally, a team of rescuers and medics would be on hand to help him out of the cabin, like lifting a china doll from its packaging. Today, there was nobody to help. Kolya and Sable both leaned over, pushing at his rump and legs, but Kolya felt weak as a kitten himself. Musa said,
this damn suit is so stiff, it fights against me.
At last, he was upright, and he pushed his head outside the capsule. Kolya saw him squint in the light, and his thick thatch of hair was blown by the wind. Then his eyes widened. He got his hands on the hull. It was still hot from the re-entry, and he had to be cautious. Then, with what seemed a superhuman effort to Kolya, he lifted himself up until he was sitting on the lip of the hatch.
Me next, Sable said.
She was visibly weakened, but compared to Musa, she seemed agile and eager. She swarmed up out of her couch and allowed Musa to help pull her up until she was sitting beside him.
My, my, she said.
Kolya, left alone in the capsule, could see nothing but their dangling legs.
What's happening? What's out there?
Musa said to Sable. Help me.
He lifted his legs out of the hatch, turned ponderously on his belly, and held up his hands to her. Then he slid down the curving side of the Soyuz and out of Kolya's sight. Sable peered down at Kolya, grinning.
Come see the show.
When Kolya forced himself to his feet, he felt as if all the blood was draining from his brain. He stood still until the feeling of fainting had dissipated a little. Then he reached up to the hatch and let Sable help him haul himself up until he was sitting at the top of the hull. Kolya was maybe 2 meters up from the ground. The descent compartment was a dome of metal sitting on the grass. From this elevation he saw the eternal steppe, flat and semi-infinite, stretching away under a great lid of cloud. It had been marked by their landing,
A series of crude gouges and craters led up to the final position of the craft. And further away, the discarded main chute lay on the ground, billowing forlornly, a startling orange against the yellow-green ground. Directly ahead of him, there was a kind of village. It was just a huddle of grubby, dome-shaped tents. People stood, men, women, and children, all bundled up in furs. They were staring at him, open-mouthed. Beyond, horses grazed, loosely tethered, unperturbed. A man walked out of the tent village. He had a broad face, deep-set black eyes that seemed very close together, and he wore a heavy full-length coat and a conical cap, both made of fur. He was holding a heavy sword of beaten iron.
"A Mongol warrior,"
Sable whispered. Kolya glanced at her.
"You expected this, didn't you? I thought there was a good chance, based on what we saw from orbit."
The breeze shifted, and a stench of cooked meat, unwashed flesh, and horse sweat hit Kolya. It was as if a veil had been torn away from his face, and suddenly he was confronted with the reality. This really was the past, or a fragment of it, and he was stranded in it. Musa was managing to stand with one hand on the hull of the spacecraft for support.
"We have fallen from space," he said to the man, smiling. "Isn't that a marvelous thing? Please,"
he held out his empty hands,
"can you help us?"
The warrior reacted so quickly, Kolya could barely follow the move. That sword flashed through the air, blurring like a helicopter blade. Moose's head flipped into the air, cut off as easily as the head of a stepped daisy, and it rolled like a football in the dirt. Moose's body still stood, the arm still outstretched, but blood gushed in a sudden fountain from the stump of his neck, running down the scuffed orange of his spacesuit. Then the body fell, rigid. Kolya stared down at Moose's severed head, scarcely able to believe what had happened. The warrior raised his sword again, but with his free hand he beckoned the others to climb down to the ground.
"Welcome to Mir," Sable muttered.
Kolya, horrified, thought he heard a note of triumph in her voice. 17. A Hard Rain. Grasper wasn't troubled by her confinement. She was so young, perhaps she had forgotten that any other way of life had ever existed. She would roam around the cage floor or climb up the netting. She would swing from the shining object that held it all up. She explored her own ears and nostrils with ruthless efficiency. As the days wore on, the men beyond the netting seemed to be growing more agitated, but they never failed to bring the man-apes their food and water. Grasper would come clambering up the net walls and try to reach out to them, and the men would reward her with extra bits of food. Seeker, though, grew withdrawn. She hated this prison and the strange creatures who had trapped her. Nobody praised her or gave her extra bits of fruit. There was nothing cute about Seeker's sullen hostility. It got worse when the rains started. The rains were sometimes so hard that the heavy drops pounded against your skin like 100 tiny fists. The man-apes were always cold and sodden, and even Grasper's bright curiosity was subdued. Sometimes the rain stung when it hit your bare flesh, your hands or feet or lips, and if it got in your eyes, it could be very painful indeed. The rain was full of acid because of events half a world away. The new world had been stitched together from fragments of the old. But those fragments had been plucked from many different eras across 2 million years. The mixing of air masses had caused the unstable weather that plagued those first days after the discontinuity. In the oceans, too, the invisible Amazons of the great currents sought a new equilibrium. And the land had been rent apart. In the Atlantic, a belt of volcanic mountains stretching south from Iceland marked the position of a mid-ocean ridge, a place where seabed was born, molten material welling up from the planet's interior. This birthing zone had been ripped open by the discontinuity. The Gulf Stream, which for millennia had delivered warm southern water to Europe, now faced a fresh obstacle, a new volcanic island that would eventually dwarf even Iceland, thrusting its way out of the ridge. Meanwhile, the Ring of Fire around the Pacific, where great tectonic plates jostled each other, lived up to its name. There was turmoil all down the western seaboard of North America, from Alaska to Washington State. Most of the 27 volcanoes in the Cascades were triggered. Mount Rainier's explosion was the worst. Its noise was a great shout that spread right around the planet. In India, it sounded like distant artillery, and the survivors of the 19th and 21st centuries stirred uneasily in their sleep. A vast mushroom cloud of ash and debris lifted high into the air's upper layers, spreading at hurricane-force speeds. Most of the debris washed out quickly, but the thin stuff lingered, blotting out the sun. Temperatures dropped,
As the air cooled, it could hold less water. All over the world it rained, and rained, and rained. In a sense, all of this was beneficial. A Frankenstein's monster of a world was trying to knit itself together, and a new equilibrium in the air, the sea, and the rocks would eventually emerge. But the painful thrashing of that healing process was devastating for anything, plant or animal, struggling to survive. Seeker had no long-term perspective. For her, there was only the present, and her present was drenched in misery, confined in the human's cruel cage, and by the acid rain that lanced down at her from the sky. When the rain was at its worst, Grasper huddled under her mother, and Seeker curled over her baby, taking the scalding downpour on her own back. Part 3. Encounters and Alliances. 18. Emissaries of Heaven. Still wielding his sword, the Mongol yelled over his shoulder. More armed men came running out of the tents. No, Kolya thought, the yurts. Women and children followed. The children were little bundles in felt coats, wide-eyed with curiosity. The men had classic Asiatic features, Kolya thought, with broad faces and small dark eyes, and jet-black hair that they wore tied back. Some had bands of cloth around their heads. They wore baggy, dun-colored trousers and went barefoot, or wore boots into which the trousers were tucked. If they weren't bare-chested, they wore simple, light tunics, heavily mended. They looked mean and strong, and they gathered threateningly around the gravity-laden cosmonauts. Kolya tried to hold his ground. He was shaking. Moose's headless corpse still lay against the side of the Soyuz, the last blood trickling from its neck. Moose's killer walked up to Sable, who glared back at him. Uncompromisingly, he grabbed her breast and compressed it. Sable did not flinch.
Holy crap, but this guy stinks.
Kolya could hear the brittleness in her voice, sense the fear under her resolve. But the warrior backed away. The men talked rapidly, eyeing the cosmonauts and their spacecraft, and the parachute silk that lay sprawled across the dusty steppe.
You know what I think they're saying? Sable whispered. That they're going to kill you. Me they'll rape. Then kill.
Try not to react, Kolya said. The tension was broken by a squeal. A little girl of about 5, with a face round as a button, had touched the wall of the Soyuz and had come away with a burned hand. The men growled as one. Moose's killer pressed his sword against Kolya's neck. His mouth was open, his eyes small, and Kolya could smell meat and milk on his breath. Suddenly the world was very vivid. The animal stink of the man before him, the rusty scent of the steppe, even the surge of blood in his ears. Was this to be his last memory before he followed Musa into the dark?
Darugachi, he said.
Tengri. Darugachi.
The man's eyes widened. He backed away, but he kept the sword raised, and the rapid conversation resumed, but now the men stared even harder. Sable hissed.
What did you say?
Schoolboy memories.
Kolya tried to keep his voice level.
I was guessing. It mightn't have been their language at all. We could have landed anywhere in time.
What language, Kolya?
Mongolian. Sable snorted.
I knew it.
I said we were emissaries. Emissaries of eternal heaven. If they believe it, they will have to treat us with respect. Hand us over to local officials, maybe. I'm bluffing. Just bluffing.
Good thinking, Batman, Sable said. After all, these guys saw us fall from the sky. Take me to your leader. Always works in the movies.
She actually laughed, a forced, ugly sound. At last, the circle around the cosmonauts began to break up, and nobody came to kill them. One man pulled on a jacket and felt hat, ran to a hobbled horse tied up beside a yurt, mounted it, and rode briskly away. The cosmonauts' hands were tied behind their backs, and they were prodded in the direction of one of the yurts. It would have been difficult to walk even without tied hands. Kolya felt as if he was encased in lead, and his head sang. Staring children, picking their noses, formed a sort of honor guard as they passed. One nasty-looking brat threw a rock that bounced off Kolya's shoulder. It was hardly a dignified return to Earth, he thought. But at least they were alive. At least he had won them some time. The door flap of the yurt was pulled open, and they were shoved inside. Sable and Kolya were thrust down onto felt mats. In their stiff pressure suits, the cosmonauts were huge in the yurt, and their legs stuck out comically in front of them. But it was a relief just to sit down. The yurt's single doorway faced south. Kolya could see the sun beyond a layer of haze. That was a Mongol tradition, Kolya knew. In their rudimentary theology, there was a strand of sun worship. And here on the plains of northern Asia, the sun wheeled through its daily circles predominantly in the south. Mongols came and went, apparently to inspect the newcomers, squat men and muscular-looking women. They stared at the cosmonauts, especially Sable, with greedy calculation. Some of the cosmonauts' gear was brought in from the Soyuz capsule. Much of this, emergency medical kits and inflatable life raft, was incomprehensible to the Mongols. But Sable and Kolya were allowed to change out of their bulky spacesuits into the lighter orange jumpsuits they had worn on orbit. The Mongol children stared at their underwear and the rubberized trousers they stripped off. The spacesuits were stacked up in a corner of the grubby yurt like abandoned cocoons. The cosmonauts both managed to conceal the existence of their sidearms, tucked behind their backs, from the Mongols. After that, to Kolya's huge relief, they were left alone for a while. He lay against the yurt's grimy wall, his limbs trembling, trying to still the beating of his heart and clear the fog in his head by sheer willpower. He should have been in the hospital right now, surrounded by state-of-the-art 21st century technology, beginning a program of physiotherapy and recuperation, not stuck in the corner of this stinking tent. He was weak as an old man, and before these stocky, powerful Mongols, he was utterly helpless. He was resentful as well as frightened. He tried to think, to take stock of his surroundings. The yurt was sturdy and well-worn. Perhaps it belonged to the chief of this little community. Its main support was a stout pole, and lighter wooden stakes and slats shaped a dome of felt. Grubby mats covered the floor, and metal pots and goatskins hung from hooks. Stacked around the walls were chests of wood and leather, the furniture of a traveling people. The yurt had no windows, but a hole in the roof had been cut over a fireplace of hearthstones where lumps of dried dung burned continually. At first, Kolya puzzled about how the yurt could be taken down and re-erected, as it must be at least twice a year as the nomads traveled between their summer and winter pastures. But he had noticed a broad cart parked a short distance away. Its bed was easily wide enough to take the intact yurt, contents and all.
"But they didn't always do that," he whispered to Sable. "The Mongols. Only in the early 13th century. Otherwise, they just dismantled the yurts like tents and carried them folded up. So that fixes us in time. We have landed in the middle of the Mongol Empire, at its peak."
"Lucky for us, you know so much about them,"
Kolya grunted.
"Lucky. Sable, the Mongols came to Russia twice. You don't forget an experience like that, not even after 8 centuries.
After a time, a meal was prepared. A woman hauled in a big iron pot. Half a sheep carcass was chopped up and thrown into the pot. Not just flesh and bones, but lungs, stomach, brains, intestines, hooves, eyeballs. Evidently nothing was wasted. The woman had a face like leather and arms like a shot putter's. As she worked steadily at the meat, she paid absolutely no attention to Sable and Kolya, as if two humans from the future stacked in the corner of her yurt were an everyday occurrence. The stranded cosmonauts did what they could to speed their adaptation to Earth's ferocious pull, surreptitiously flexing their joints, shifting their posture to favor one muscle group over another. Aside from that, they had nothing to do but wait, Kolya supposed, for that rider to return from his mission to the local official, at which point the decision about their fate would be made, a decision that could still, he knew, mean their deaths. But despite that grim prospect, as the afternoon wore by, Kolya astonishingly grew bored. The mass of meat and offal in the pot was boiled for a couple of hours. Then more adults and children crowded into the yurt. Some of them brought in more meat for the pot, bits of what looked like foxes, mites, rabbits. These were roughly skinned but not cleaned. Kolya could see bits of grit and dried blood sticking to them. When it was time to eat, the Mongols just dived in. They scooped out chunks of meat with wooden bowls and ate with their fingers. They washed it down with cups of what looked like milk poured from a sweating goatskin. Sometimes, if they didn't like the flavor of a piece of meat after a few bites, they would throw it back, and they would spit bits of gristle back into the pot. Sable watched this in horror, and nobody washed their hands before lunch. "For the Mongols, water has divine purity," Kolya said. "You don't sully it by using it to wash."
"So how do they keep clean?"
"Welcome to the 13th century, Sable."
The guests kept their distance from the cosmonauts, but otherwise their social life seemed unimpeded. After a time, one of the younger men approached the cosmonauts, carrying a bowl of meat.
Collier saw how the mutton fat that shone on the boy's lips was only the topmost layer in a smear of fat and dirt that covered his face. There was even wind-dried snot under his broad nostrils, and his stink, like overripe cheese, was just overwhelming. The boy reached behind Collier and released one of his hands. Then he picked out a piece of meat from his bowl and held it out to Collier. His fingernails were black with dirt.
"You know," Collier murmured, "the Mongols would soften their meat by riding with it under their saddle. This bit of mutton might have spent days being pumped full of methane from some fat herdsman's ass."
"Eat it," murmured Sable. "We need the peptides."
Collier took the meat, closed his eyes, and bit into it. It was leathery and tasted of fat and butter. Later, the boy brought him a cup of milk. It actually had a kick, and he vaguely remembered that the Mongols would ferment mare's milk. He drank as little as he could. After the meal, the cosmonauts were allowed out, separately, to relieve themselves, heavily watched all the time. Collier took the chance to look around. The plain stretched around him, huge and empty, an elemental sheet of yellow dust broken by splashes of green. Under an ashen sky, fat clouds sailed, casting shadows like lakes. But the land, vast and flat and featureless, seemed to dwarf the sky itself. This was the Mongolian plateau. He knew that much from their navigation during the descent. Nowhere much less than 1,000 meters above sea level, it was shut off from the rest of Asia by great natural barriers. Mountain ranges to the west, the Gobi Desert to the south, the Siberian forests to the north. From orbit, he remembered, it had been a vast blank, a faintly crumpled plain stitched here and there with the threads of rivers. Barely there at all, like the preliminary sketch of a landscape. And now here he was, stuck in the middle of it all. And in this vast emptiness, the village huddled. The yurts, mud-colored, weather-beaten, and rounded, looked more like eroded boulders than anything made by humans. The battered Soyuz descent compartment did not somehow look particularly out of place here. But children ran and laughed, and neighbors called from one yurt to the next. Collier could see animals, sheep, goats, and horses moving in unfenced herds, their lows and bleating carrying in the still air. Though he might be as much as 8 centuries out of time, and though there could hardly have been a greater contrast in his origins with these peoples, spaceman and nomad, the most technologically advanced humans put together with some of the most primitive, the basic grammar of human discourse was unchanged, he saw, and he had come to a little island of human warmth in the midst of the huge, silent emptiness of the plain. Somehow that was reassuring, even if he was a Russian fallen into the hands of Mongols. That night, Collier and Sable huddled together under a foul-smelling blanket of what smelled like horsehair. The snores of the Mongols were all around them. But whenever Collier looked up, one of them always seemed to be awake, his eyes gleaming in the dim firelight. Collier didn't believe he slept at all. Sable, on the other hand, just rested her head against Collier's shoulder and slept for hours at a time. He was astonished at her courage. In the night, the wind rose up, and the yurt creaked and rocked, like a boat adrift on the sea of the steppe. Collier, relentlessly awake, wondered what had become of Casey. 19. The Delta. His breakfast over, Secretary Eumenes dismissed his pages. He pulled his purple cloak over his shoulders and, pushing the heavy leather door flap out of his way, walked out of his tent. The clouds had cleared away, revealing a washed-out blue sky, pale like faded paint, and the morning sun was hot. At least the rain had stopped for once. But when he looked west to the sea, Eumenes could see more black clouds bubbling and boiling, and he knew that another storm was on its way. Even the natives who clustered around the army camp selling charms and gewgaws and the bodies of their children claimed never to have known such weather. Eumenes set off toward Hephaestion's tent. It was difficult going. The ground had been turned to soft yellow mud, churned up by the feet of men and animals that clung to Eumenes' cavalry boots. Around him, the smoke of 1,000 fires rose to the pale sky. The men were emerging from their tents, hefting clothing and gear heavy with mud. Some of them shaved off their stubble. An order to be clean-shaven had been one of the king's earliest initiatives when he had taken over the army from his assassinated father, ostensibly so that enemies would not be given an easy handhold in close quarters. The Macedonians moaned, as usual, about this fancy Greek practice and about the wretched, barbarous state of this place the king had brought them to. Soldiers always liked to grumble, but when the fleet had first arrived here in the Delta, having sailed down the Indus from the king's camp, Eumenes himself had been appalled by the heat, the stink, the clouds of insects that had hovered over the marshy ground. But Eumenes prided himself on his disciplined mind. A wise man got on with his business, whatever the weather. It even rains on god kings, he thought. Hephaestion's tent was a grand affair, far grander than Eumenes. A sign of the favor with which the king regarded his closest companion. The living quarters were surrounded by a series of vestibules and antechambers, and were guarded by a detachment of shield-bearers, the army's elite infantry, reputed to be the finest foot soldiers in the world. As Eumenes neared the tent, he was challenged. The guard was a Macedonian, of course. He certainly knew Eumenes, yet he stood before the secretary now, holding up his stabbing sword. Eumenes held his ground, his gaze unflinching, and eventually the soldier backed down. The hostility of a Macedonian warrior for a Greek administrator was as inevitable as the weather, even if it was founded on ignorance. For how do these half-barbarians imagine that the great machinery of the army kept them all alive and provisioned, organized and directed, if not for the meticulous work of Eumenes' secretariat? Eumenes pushed his way into the tent without glancing back. The vestibule was a mess. Chamberlains and pages righted tables, gathered up fragments of smashed crockery and bits of ripped clothing, and mopped up wine and what looked like blood-stained vomit. Last night, Hephaestion had evidently once more been entertaining his commanders and other guests. Hephaestion's usher was a small, fat, fussy man with peculiar strawberry-blonde hair. When he had kept Eumenes waiting in the vestibule for just the precise time required to reinforce his own position, he bowed and waved Eumenes forward into Hephaestion's private chambers. Hephaestion was on his couch, loosely covered by a sheet, and still in his nightshirt. He was the center of industry. Chamberlains laid out clothes and brought in food, and a file of pages brought in jugs of water. Hephaestion himself, propped up on one elbow, picked languidly at a tray of meat. There was a stirring under the sheet. A boy, eyes heavy with sleep, emerged and sat up, looking bewildered. Hephaestion smiled at him. He touched his fingers to his own lips, and then the boy's, and patted his shoulder. "Go now." The boy clambered off the couch, naked. A chamberlain pulled a cloak around him and led him from the chamber. Eumenes, waiting by the entrance, tried not to show his disdain for all this. He had lived and worked with these Macedonians long enough to understand them. Under their kings, they had been welded into a force capable of conquering the world. But they were highland tribesmen, only a couple of generations removed from their ancestral traditions. Eumenes could even strive to join in with their revels when it was politic to do so. But still, some of these pages were the sons of Macedonian nobility, sent to serve the king's officers in order to complete their education. Eumenes could only imagine what impression it must make on such young men when they spent their mornings mopping up the stinking detritus of some barbarian warrior in his cups, or spent their nights serving his needs in other ways.